Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the Deferred Action Podcast. I hope everyone listening is doing well and remaining healthy in these trying times. We're very excited to share this special episode of the Deferred Action Podcast. This episode features Mr. Hector Galvan. Hector is a friend of the podcast, and he came highly recommended by Ms. Dana Cerón. He immigrated to the U.S. at the age of 3 months and says himself he's a Houstonian at heart. We talked to Hector about his roots growing up in Houston, his relationship with his immigration status, learning from his parents' entrepreneurial spirit, which I'm sure many will love, mental health aspects of being a first-generation college student, and the importance of social entrepreneurship. So without further ado, please enjoy this incredible episode with Mr. Hector Galvan. Okay, good deal. So we always like to start with an icebreaker. And I'm sure you've heard it, so maybe you've thought about it. But what'd you have for breakfast?
Great question. Saturdays, I like to spoil myself because during the week, I drink smoothies for breakfast. Mm. So this morning, I made myself a breakfast sandwich. So like bread, eggs, ham, cheese, the good stuff.
That's awesome. Yeah. That's amazing, man. Yeah, we've had a lot of people talk about like smoothies, but that's like one of my favorite breakfasts as well. That and tomorrow I'm having barbacoa.
Ooh, so, Sunday barbacoas and carnitas.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
It's going to go down.
We in our family, we do something similar. Not every weekend, but on Sundays, those are the days. Like we get barbacoa, carnitas, tortillas, salsa. Oh man, hits a spot.
So tell us, who's Hector Galvan today? Who are you, brother?
Well, that's a great question. I'm a Houstonian. I've lived here my entire life, pretty much. I'm currently working as a consultant for a local treasury advisory company. But that's always a hard question because I'm always trying to challenge myself and push myself to evolve and change and grow towards a better Hector. So it changes week by week, and I'm just trying to figure things out as I go, pretty much.
At what age did you come here to the United States?
I was 3 to 4 months old. Wow. When I got here.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you were like a baby.
I was a baby, yeah. So I was born in 1996. Mm-hmm. We were currently living in San Luis Potosí, mm-hmm. Mexico. My dad currently had a job selling truck parts. He was going all around the Republic of Mexico selling truck parts, going state by state. And he was going to get a promotion. I want to say a month after I was born, that promotion fell through. He and my mom were trying to figure out what to do. Mm-hmm. They were barely making ends meet, mm-hmm. and opportunities just weren't
there.
Yeah, they just weren't there at the time, and literally that same day that my dad got the news that the promotion was wasn't going through is the night that they decided that they were going to be moving to the United States.
Did you have any family over here, or did they just kind of decide they heard about, you know, coming to the U.S. or, you know, in my case, like we had family over here that told us, like, you know, why don't you guys come over here and just, you know, try it out and see how it is living over here? Or was it just kind of like a decision that they're just like, let's go?
It was mostly a decision of let's go. We did have an uncle that lived in Chicago at the time, but that was the only family we had. Mm-hmm. We had family friends that were living in Houston that we knew, and my parents knew we could crash with them. My dad decided to come here to the United States first and find a couple of jobs where he can provide for the family. Mm-hmm. And I want to say like 3 weeks later, my mom and I came to the United States afterwards, and we were living at a family friend's home, and they were nice enough to bring us in, but they didn't like provide a bed or anything. So we had to figure out, like, my mom had to figure out, where are we going to sleep this child? Like, we don't have a crib to go and sleep him in. And I don't know. It was very, and this is all from what my parents talked to me and how.
What part of Houston?
It was around the Greensport area.
Okay.
Yeah. Really? Yeah. Yeah. So it was, we lived there for, I want to say half a year, about 6 months, until we eventually moved to our own rental home. But yeah, I was very, very young, 3 or 4 months. So when I say I've lived here my entire life, I basically lived here my entire life. I consider myself a Houstonian. Yeah.
No, fair enough. It makes perfect sense. And yeah. When did you have this conversation with your parents? Was it something you've always wanted to talk to them about, or were they more proactive?
I think it's something they brought up, but it's interesting because I never really thought about my status or my immigration status until DACA. So we never really discussed anything of like, hey, mom, dad, like, am I like a U.S. citizen or like my Mexican citizen? It was never really discussed. And my parents are very, not very, I want to say, they're not as an open book. They don't like to discuss things that don't have to be discussed at the time.
Sure.
So it wasn't a conversation that came up in my early ages. It's more something more towards when I was like 17, 18, when those conversations had to come up and I was looking for college to go to and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah, that makes sense. And yeah. we'll come back to that 17, 18, but yeah. Going back to your relationship with Mexico and with San Luis, you said, right?
San Luis Potosí, correct.
What is your relationship with San Luis? Like, how do you feel about that place now?
So my parents and I came to the United States with a visa, a tourist visa. So for the first, I want to say 10 years, we would go to Mexico yearly for Christmas and holidays. But I don't have a lot of memories from Mexico. I have memories of like going to different stores and different family houses and spending Christmas there, but not a lot of like memories, just like brief snippets of time where I can recall. But honestly, like, my memory of Mexico is not very clear. It's not a place where I've spent a lot of time, but I've heard a lot of stories. I've heard a lot of things from family members and my parents. They always talk about X, Y, and Z. Like, oh man, like, you should go to. My parents originate from Cerritos, San Luis Potosí, which is the pueblo that they grew up in. And they always talk about the food. The food is always something they always talk about, and something we always keep close to our heart is the Mexican cuisine, and something we always brag about. So,
what's your favorite Mexican food?
Oh man, so much to choose from. That's an interesting question. Barbacoa is always something I love, and carnitas. That's why
I saw your mouth salivate whenever I said that earlier. Man. I was like, "Damn, he's drooling right now."
The thing is that, like, my dad makes delicious barbacoa and carnitas. It's always something that's been close to the family, and it's always something that's that I've had growing up. So it's always taco de barbacoa con carnitas y salsa y cilantro y cebolla, all that. Oh man.
That sounds good.
Yeah.
Well, that sounds delicious. That's my plan for tomorrow for sure. Oh, barbacoa.
Yeah, you can't go wrong with that.
So, you know, how did you transition from your family? How did y'all come to Houston? What was the what was the method?
Yeah. So we crossed the border with our visas at the time. At the time, it was very easy to get a visa and renew your visa year to year. And then eventually they expired, and it wasn't as easy as it used to be. After 9/11, things got really hard, and there was one final trip to Mexico that I remember very clearly, because on our way to Mexico we got stopped, and we were...
How old were you?
I want to say I was like 10 years old. It might have been 9-10 years old. I don't remember the specific year, but we were on our way to one of my uncle's funerals. And we got stopped on the way there by the police, and they like searched our car. They brought dogs, and it was just like a very hard and very
scary, right?
Scary and negative memory to have for your final trip to Mexico. That at the time we were like, okay, we can't go back. Like our visas were very close to expiring, and a couple years later they expired, and we just decided never to. It was just hard to renew, and but we lived here with a visa for, I want to say, our first 12 years of our life here in the United States.
That's great.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Tell us about how your parents have transitioned to America, and what they did those first 12 years with the visa, and kind of what happened with your family in that time.
So when my parents and I got here to Houston, we lived with a family friend. About half a year later, my dad was working three jobs. He was working at a carniceria, at a dealership, cleaning cars, and with one of my uncles that had recently, the uncle that lived in Chicago came down to Houston, and he had started a business. So my dad was working for him at the time. So he was working three jobs. And
what kind of business did he start?
It was also carniceria, taqueria, carniceria, yeah.
Nice. In that alley area. That's why he knows how to make good barbacoa. And
yeah, exactly. Yeah, it actually runs. Yeah, it runs in the family. I don't personally know, and maybe one day I will. But he was working three jobs at the time, and they eventually we moved to a rental home, same in that Greens Point area, and then I want to say a couple of years later, my mom talked to a neighbor, and she was selling a small tortilla machine. So what it would do is press the dough into the tortilla form to make the flour tortilla. So my mom took the opportunity and bought the machine from our neighbor with cash and in payments. And she decided that she wanted to start making tortillas. She knew how to make tortillas, and she wanted to make tortillas and sell them to the corner store by her house. So my mom just started making tortillas and packing them up, and she told my dad, like, hey, like, can we like go sell these at the carniceria or the corner store? And my dad was like, yeah, I think I can go and talk to them and see if we can sell them these. And they started doing that, and one thing led to another, and next thing you know, they're like operating this business out of their home. And I have very vivid memories of sleeping on pallets of flour bags at home, because they were just making tortillas for a few carnicerias and local stores, and they were making a living out of it. And my dad was still currently working a couple of jobs, but they were making ends meet, and they were trying to figure out how to do things. And next thing you know, my parents are opening up their own shop in the Alding area, where they're just producing corn and flour tortillas all day. And my dad decided to quit his jobs and dedicate most of the time to this business. And my parents they did that for, I want to say, 13 years.
Wow.
After those 13 years, they were like, okay, I think we're done. We're going to be selling this business. So they're very entrepreneurial at heart.
Yeah.
So back in Mexico, my mom used to cut hair. She used to sell donuts. She used to sell hot dogs. My dad would sell truck parts, and they're both very entrepreneurial, and they're always looking for that, for a way to make money and do it mm-hmm. their way and by themselves, you know?
Yeah.
So they've ever since the tortilla business, they've had food distribution companies and carnicerias and bakeries, and they're back at it at the tortilla thing, and they're still doing that after 24 years.
That's awesome.
Yeah, so...
So would you say that they're like a big like inspiration that led you to become yourself, to go into like becoming an entrepreneur?
Yeah, 1,000%. And it's always something that I don't think they ever wanted me to do.
Yeah,
they're like, you don't want to be like us. Yeah. You don't want to be working like 60
crazy
plus
hours.
Yeah. In a week. And I saw them working, like mm-hmm. getting up at 3 a.m. and coming home at 12. And mm-hmm. I was always next to them. I was always like, they would bring me to the tortilla factory, and
yeah.
I would be sleeping on like flour pallets or a couch. And so they were always like, oh, I don't want this. Like, I don't want you to be living this lifestyle.
Yeah.
But it's always something they've done and wanted to do. And mm-hmm. I don't think they ever see themselves working for someone. But yeah, it's definitely, they're definitely an inspiration. Because I don't know. I want to say they're happy. I've always seen them like thrive in this sort of environment, and it's always something that I have really admired mm-hmm. in them. They're hard workers. They're like more than just hard workers. They're very passionate about what they do.
Yeah. And it's not easy coming from a different country and then coming to the United States and then having to learn all the rules, the language, all the process that it takes to start. I mean, obviously starting a business, you know, it's not easy. It looks easy, but when you actually start doing it, it's a lot of work.
Yeah.
And for them to, you know, not having a status here, not knowing like 100% the language, not knowing all the terminology, all the connections. Sure. That makes it 100 times harder than it is for a regular person when they're starting their own business. So that's very admirable. And I see that in a lot of immigrant communities. Most immigrants mm-hmm. are the definition of what an entrepreneur is.
Yep.
They come here and they literally start, they have nothing. And they start their own empire, which I find is super amazing, because it's like this nation really does run, you know, by all the labor that, you know, the immigrants come here and create businesses.
Yeah.
And I think it's important for us to bring awareness to all those mm-hmm. immigrants who have started an amazing business and have, you know, created it into something where it's creating revenue for our country, and it's providing for our country, and it's building jobs and opportunities.
Yeah.
So that's amazing to hear that your parents, you know, did this for 20 years and plus. I had no idea.
Yeah. And they're still doing it. And it's crazy because when I told them I was going to be applying to this entrepreneurship program, they were like, what is that? Like, what is an entrepreneur? When I tried to explain them the concept of an entrepreneur, they're like, they have no idea like what that concept is. They mm-hmm. just know that like, this is what they do, mm-hmm. and they don't even know they're entrepreneurs. It's crazy.
Like, to them, like having to say the word entrepreneurship, it's pretty funny. I remember having to like explain my parents a little backstory. Mm-hmm. You know, you also graduated from the Wolf Center for Entrepreneurship, mm-hmm. Class of 2019, and I recently graduated class of 2020, and that's where we met. I would remember telling my mom like, oh, I'm going into this entrepreneurship program. And she was like, why can't you choose a major that's easy for me to pronounce? She was like, I cannot say that word. And it's so funny, because when I would go back home to Colombia, mm-hmm. I would tell all my aunts and my uncles, and I have like a video of all of them like trying to say entrepreneurship. And it's so funny.
Yeah. Yeah. I tried to explain it to them, and I don't think they still,
they had no idea that they were actually entrepreneurs.
Exactly. But I think that it's very important to highlight that fact that mm-hmm. so many immigrants come here and just try to figure things out. Like, they might not have like a work permit or a way to work legally, but they try to make ends meet one way or another. Yeah. And whether it be selling tortillas or selling flowers at the corner or whatever way you can make ends meet, mm-hmm. they try to figure it out. And it's hard. It's not easy. And it's definitely something I'm very passionate about, is bringing those different resources mm-hmm. and tools that the Hispanic community can use to, if they want to be entrepreneurs, they want to do their own thing, provide them with the tools they need to thrive in this mm-hmm. in this environment, because it's not easy. There's mm-hmm. a language barrier, like you mentioned. Mm-hmm. There's different policies and rules that you never even really even think about. So it's very important to highlight that fact.
Since we're talking about your parents, one thing that Ugo and I always talked about was, you know, was there any time where you felt resentment towards your parents because of your situation where you were at, and you were why did you guys do it this way? Was there any resentment? Did you ever have a conversation with them about that?
Yeah, so I think it was around the time where I was applying to colleges, and I was sort of coming around and figuring out that I am not, I don't have a social security number. There's I can't apply to XYZ scholarships. I wanted to go to a certain school, and I knew that because of my current situation, I couldn't do those things. And it was around that time when I was 16, 17, where I sort of grasped the reality. And I want to say I had a little bit of resentment, but I also have a lot of respect for my parents because of what they did and the sacrifices they made. They didn't know what was going to happen here. They didn't know what was going to happen once they decided to move to the United States, and they left family behind, and they left friends and family. And it was uncertainty that they were going towards. And I respect them for that. But yeah, there's always that. There were always that resentment growing up, saying that oh man, I wish I could be like my friends. I wish I could be like my best friend and go to UT with him. And he had gotten all these scholarships, and I was I can't. And yeah, but yeah, there was that small time of resentment where I was oh man, I wish things could be different. But I don't know. Nowadays I'm more than anything, I have so much respect for my parents, and I care for them a lot. I have a deep connection with them, and I think they made the right decision, but we just have to figure things out as we go. Yeah.
Yeah. So recently I took a trip to South Padre.
Yeah.
And in my boredom, I watched Spanglish again. Mm, and mm-hmm. man, that movie is so profound.
Yeah.
Because at the end of the movie, and I'm sorry, spoiler alert for whoever hasn't watched it. At the end of the movie, the mom that's cleaning the house for Adam Sandler's family mm-hmm. decides to leave. And her daughter doesn't want to leave the mm-hmm. rich, white American lifestyle in Malibu or whatever.
Yeah.
And she asks the daughter, why are you trying to be less like me? Are you trying to be more like them or just less like me?
Mm-hmm.
And man, that hit me.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was going to ask you, Hector, you saw your parents be entrepreneurs in every sense. So what'd you learn from them that you're applying now in, you know, your coming of age
yeah.
as an entrepreneur? What are you going to take from them?
Just that anything is possible. If you put in the time and energy and the work, it's anything is possible. If you want to go and make XYZ business, it's possible, as long as you have the passion, energy, and time. Anything is possible. You'll figure out a way. There's always a way. If there's a will, there's a way. And that's the one thing I've always admired about them. They're not afraid to take leaps, and that's something I'm trying to currently apply towards where I'm at and where I'm going. But it's also not easy, but I always have them as role models, and I always take, that's something I really, really respect from them, is they're not afraid of anything. If they want to do it, they'll figure out a way.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
Would that, like, you know, entrepreneurial spirit, was that existent in you when you were in elementary school, when you were young? Or who were you as an elementary school student?
I was an interesting kid. I've always been an introvert at heart, and I still consider myself an introvert. But growing up, I was that weird, quiet kid that. I grew up in we moved to the Spring area after a few years. We moved into the Spring area into like a nice community, but we were definitely that minority. We were one of the first, I think we were the first minorities to buy a house in that community. So it was very interesting growing up, because there's not a lot you can relate to with the kids in the neighborhood. And the kids, I moved from like the Greenspoint area to the Spring area, and at the time it was like I was going to elementary school, and I went from a very Hispanic, where the Hispanics were the minority, mm-hmm. to where I'm like the minority at this elementary school. And one, I'm like very introverted, and it's very hard to make friends. And then moving into this environment where I'm just, it's very hard to adapt. Mm-hmm. So I always grew up as like the quiet kid, and it was an interesting growing up, because it's hard for me to make friends. But eventually, like, one of my first like friends I made was in my ESL class. His name was Hung, and he was mm-hmm. a Vietnamese. He also did not know a lot of English, and I didn't know a lot of English. So we were talking in the elementary school, and then like one day we realized that we were neighbors. Like, he literally lives next door, and I had no idea. And that's where our friendship sort of started, and we would play like basketball. And that was like one of my only friends growing up in elementary school, and I was really close to him. And it made like growing up a little bit easier, because we were like one of the two minorities like mm-hmm. in that neighborhood, but we would have a good time. And but it was very interesting growing up.
We always ask this question, like, who was like that one friend that kind of helped you throughout like either elementary or middle school or high school that you kind of were able to identify with? Or, I mean, they don't specifically have to be an American, mm-hmm. Or it can be anyone, but I love how you already answered. So you would say that you and him like identified a lot, and y'all became really good friends.
Yeah, we definitely did. And eventually he had to move out because his parents mm-hmm. unfortunately divorced, and I was left sort of like, oh man, I miss my uh-huh. friend. And I had to find a way to sort of adapt. And that's when I started meeting the rest of the kids in the neighborhood, and mm-hmm. Trying to go out and play and go around and ride bikes and play baseball that I'd never really heard of the sport, but I knew it was a thing. And I was a soccer kid, and it was interesting adapting to that sort of environment. But yeah, he was very helpful, and he was a wonderful friend. And we were trying to figure things out together, and neither of us were like Americans at heart. So
yeah,
he would show me his culture, and I would show him my culture. That's like awesome. He would come over to my house, and we'd show him all these interesting dishes that he had never heard about. And he was like,
what's his name again?
Hung.
Hung. Well, yeah. Shout out to Hung.
Shout out to Hung. Yeah. I haven't talked to him in years now, but I know he went to U of H as well. But shout out to Hung. He was very instrumental in my first years in elementary school, for sure.
And we all kind of, Ugo, you and I, like, we all kind of came from, like, we all grew up kind of in the same area without even like knowing it.
Yeah.
And we were all like in the Spring area. You actually graduated from the same high school that I graduated. Yeah. I graduated 2013 and you graduated 2014.
Yeah.
So it's such a small world. And I like 100% like relate to you, because I lived in the Greenspoint area for mm-hmm. around like 6 years.
Mm-hmm.
I went from Aldine, where there was like all my friends were.
Yeah.
Pretty much all Hispanic, and I, you know, the primary language that was spoken was Spanish. And then you know, I was in elementary and then going into middle school, it's like middle school is such an awkward age where you're like trying to figure out like who the hell you are and like who are your friends and all this stuff. You're trying to be cool.
Yeah.
And I come into like middle school and, you know, I always identify. I will always remember this. You know, I come in and I'm wearing like Jordans and, you know, like this. I forgot that. Okay, not a chola. But I was wearing like these Jordans and like these like, I forgot, I think it was like Bobby Air. I can't remember the name, but it was like a very I came the first day dressed like that. And I remember people like looking at me weird. And, you know, I had never heard of Abercrombie, Hollister, Aeropostale, all those brands. I've never heard of them. And then I remember like seeing them, like all the girls like, oh my gosh, I went shopping and I got, you know, this new Abercrombie shirt. And I was like, what is that? And people were like, oh my gosh, you wear Jordans. I wear Converse or Vans. And I'm just like, it was a whole new world. And I remember identifying like through fashion. I was like, oh my gosh, like, you know, these kids are dressing different than I am. Maybe I should adjust to the way that they're dressing. Mm-hmm. Because we actually were one of the first, we were one of the few Hispanic families to also, our neighborhood is really small. It's like probably the smallest neighborhood in Spring. And we were like one of the first Hispanic families. Yeah. So yeah, it was like, we were the odd ones. Yeah. And, you know, I feel like that, I would always remember that moment with the fashion.
Yeah.
Where I was able to identify myself like, okay, Why am I dressing like this? Like, yeah, they're calling that. I thought this was cool.
Yeah.
I'm wearing Jordans. Like, and so I think for me, that was like that time. And you know, for you, when you were in middle school, what middle school did you go to?
I went to Twin Creeks Middle School. Okay. So that's in the spring. I went to Spring ISD most of my life up until high school.
Okay.
So I relate to that as well, because I also went from like dressing differently and mm-hmm. realizing that everyone around me was dressing like with Abercrombie and all these like interesting brands. I shifted myself and I started buying all these different brands, and it's
My mom would always tell me like, oh, those are nice clothes, but we're going to shop the cell.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yep.
We would always go shop the cell. Mm-hmm. And for high school, you know, like, did you have any close friends? Or, you know, for me, I adapted really quick, really, really quick to the crowd.
Mm-hmm.
I really didn't know who I was back then. So I was trying to fit in as much as I can. Like in all my pictures, the homecoming pictures and all that, you see like blonde, blonde, blonde. And then mm-hmm. there's like this Hispanic girl and that was me.
Yeah.
You know, I was very surrounded by the American culture, but none of my friends knew about my situation. Yeah. Did you tell any of your closest friends while you were in high school and middle school about your situation?
So in middle school, once I reached middle school, I got to this middle school that was a little bit more diverse. And I started making friends, and I was living in that spring. I went to that Spring ISD district for almost from elementary to middle school to the end of middle school. And then at the end of middle school, we decided to move to the Klein district. So it was an interesting change for me, going from like one middle school and then switching districts and going to a completely other. And it's hard for me to make friends. So it was an interesting shift. But in middle school, I want to say I had a couple of friends. One of them still my best friend. He knew about my situation, but that was it. Like, only that one friend knew like who I was and where I came from, because I forget how the conversation came up, but I one day told him and he's like, okay, yeah, that's cool. Anyways, so he's always known, but going into high school, it was a completely different crowd. So it was hard for me to readjust and make new friends and all that sort of stuff. And I don't think I ever told anyone in high school, but I have an interesting memory from high school that I guess has always been ingrained in my memory. I think it was junior or senior year. I was sitting in one of my like engineering classes. It was like a computer class, and I forget how the conversation came up, but there was a guy sitting next to me and he was talking about like immigration and undocumented people. And he was like they shouldn't be here. Like, they're breaking the law. And like, he turns to me and he's like, Hector, you're not legal. Like, you're not illegal, are you? Are you? And I was like, I froze. Like I didn't say anything. And he's like, if you are, I'm gonna call ICE on you. And I was like, I was freaking out. I was like, my heart was pounding. And it's always something that's been like ingrained in my memory, because it was like around that time that I realized that I was like, I was undocumented. So it definitely, like, I guess, traumatized me in a way. And I've always been that quiet kid. But even with that, I'm like, I don't want to tell anyone. Like, I don't want to talk to anyone about this. Like, I don't want to know. I don't want people to know, like, who I am, because you don't know what, like, might happen. So after that, like, after that incident, I sort of like shut down and decided to not really talk to anyone about my situation, except my close friends. And it wasn't something that I really talked about until college. Until, like, I want to say my last year in college.
Yeah. No, I mean, you were put on the spot, literally. And I had the same thing. I was in, I grew up with American friends, and remember being in dinner, and I always wanted to tell them, because I did consider them my friends when we were in high school. Like, I was like, they're my friends. I could tell them everything. And I was like, I'm going to one day tell them, because they all knew where I was from. They all knew that I was from Colombia, but they didn't think I was like, here illegally. They thought that maybe I was just like on a visa or something. I don't know what they thought, but they thought I was good. Yeah. And, during dinners, like, their parents like would have really strong conversations about how they felt about immigrants. And I'm here sitting in their like dining room eating with them, and they're bashing me and my family out. Mm-hmm. And I'm just like it was a moment where I felt really uncomfortable. Yeah. But at the same time, like, I was so wrapped up in like, no, I just need to fit in. I just need to fit in. Yeah. That's not who I am. I don't want them to feel sorry for me. That's one thing that I always hate. I didn't want people to feel, oh, that's the poor girl.
Yeah.
No, I never liked that. So, I mean, that was always a struggle that I dealt with when I was in high school, being afraid to speak up and saying, I'm an immigrant.
Yeah.
And I think that's for most of us too. It's always a struggle.
Yeah. And I, even like growing up, my parents were always like, you have to blend in. You have to,
you have to be careful. You have to watch out
for sure. Like, my mom would always be like, I would tell them about a new friend. Mm-hmm. And she would be like, you didn't tell them about like who you are.
Yeah.
Like, and I'm like, no, don't worry. Like, I was always raised to sort of, and my parents always told me to blend in and never get in trouble, and make sure you're not doing anything stupid, and you, like, you're not like other kids. You're not like, you could get like, we could get deported. And that's always like conversation that gets brought up, like, in our family, is that you have to be careful, and you have to make sure that you're blending in and doing things right, or else you're going to get in trouble. So, yeah.
Interesting. Speaking about blending in, what kind of student were you?
Consider myself a smart student, but I am like, I would have to study hours and hours and hours to get a good grade. But I was always pressured to make A's and B's, and making sure that I'm keeping my grades up. And that was the kind of student that I was, is just like studying as much as I can and making sure I'm turning in homework. And my parents were always on me to do my homework, and I'd be like, I don't understand, like, can you help me? And they're like, no, we can't, we don't have a college education, we can't, like, we don't know what this is. So I was always pressured to make A's and B's, and making sure that I was a good student and wasn't speaking up, and I was getting like that, I was making sure that I was just blending in, making sure that I was doing everything right and following the system. And I mean, that's just how my parents were, and that's how I was raised. So,
yeah. What's your favorite subject?
Math.
Math. Okay.
Yeah, math.
Nice.
Yeah.
Why math?
It's just always been something that
made sense.
To me. Yeah. And I even took like a few. I didn't minor and major in math, but I took a few extra classes just for the fun of it in college. So I've always been a math geek, but that's always been my favorite subject, mostly because it's just, for me, it was just logical. Like, things just made sense. Like, reading and writing isn't my forte. So I was either like reading, writing, like history. No, I don't like, I'm sorry. Like, it's just not my thing. I can't memorize all these dates, and math is just, for me, is just, there was logic to it. And I just enjoyed it.
For sure. Not to get too nerdy, because it's not a math podcast, but what's your favorite math subject? Algebra, calculus?
Calculus.
Calculus? Okay,
yeah.
Nice.
Yeah.
Yeah. Calculus is my favorite too. All right. Yeah. Back to the DACA stuff. So do your parents speak English relatively well, or are they primarily Spanish speaking?
In the household, we're purely Spanish. Like, we don't speak anything else. It's just Spanish. My dad, his English is, okay enough to have a conversation with. My mom, a little bit less. They've both tried to go to, like, community college and take English classes, but my mom, she's just like, this isn't my thing. I'm sorry. I'm not gonna go through this. But their English is enough to have a conversation with them. Yeah,
that's great. I mean, I was shocked to hear, like, your family bought a home. Like, that's incredible. Yeah. You know, and it takes a certain level of literacy financially,
yeah,
to get that done.
Yeah.
But a lot of DACA recipients serve the role of problems, like English problem solver.
Yep.
Like, for me personally, I always had to call the cable companies,
yep,
to negotiate better rates on our, mm-hmm, cable deals, or AT&T, you know, yeah, horrible they can be or whatever.
Yeah.
Did you ever have to do that in any capacity?
All the time, yeah. Yeah.
Tell us about that.
Everywhere I would go, especially with my mom, it was like, hey, like, tell this guy on the phone that, like, I want to tell him X, Y, and Z. And I was like, my introverted self, I'm like, okay, I think I know. Like, so I was always playing that role of translating and helping my parents out. But even when I wasn't there, they would figure out a way to communicate, whether it was through words, whether it was through, like, writing something down, they would always figure something out. But no, like, most of the time, and even still to this day, I'm helping them, like, translate and talking with, like, the cable company and, like, making sure that, like, my parents get their word across. And I always play that part, for sure.
Yeah. Are you an only child?
I have an older sister.
Okay.
It was interesting growing up, because after we moved here to the United States, she actually came with us.
Mm-hmm.
But my grandfather passed away, like, about a year after I was born.
Mm-hmm.
And in order to sort of help my grandma out back in Mexico with everything, my parents decided to send my sister over. Wow. Down to Mexico. So she grew up. She was there for the first, like, 15 years while we were over here. So I didn't grow up with her, but we've always, like, we're siblings. Now she's currently living here in Houston. And
okay.
But I grew up sort of like as an only child, but I do have an older sister. She's in her, like, late 30s now, so it's a lot older. So but I grew up sort of feeling like an only child in a way. Yeah.
So is your sister in Mexico still?
No, she moved. She moved to Houston when she was in her mid-20s.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And do you have a good relationship with her, I'd imagine?
Yeah, for sure. Like I said, we didn't grow up together, so we don't have, like, as much of a connection per se. But we do have a good relationship. She's always off doing her own thing. And but yeah, I sort of closely relate to her, but we also grew up in different environments, and she grew up, like, in school. She went to school in Mexico, and she went to a few years of college in Mexico. So our sort of environments where we grew up in were a little bit different. So we don't always relate as well, but we do. We have a close relationship either way.
Yeah, that's really interesting. She's almost, like, truly Mexican.
Yeah.
And you, me, and Dana were, like, hybrids of something.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, hybrids, that's interesting. Yeah, that's, I never know how to define myself, because and this is a common topic with DACA recipients and dreamers, is, like, we're we're too Hispanic to be like, we're too like, I don't know, I'm too Mexican to be white, but too white to be Mexican. It's always like an interesting conversation you have with your like cousins and like with friends that are maybe a little bit more Hispanic like as you are. I never know how to define myself, and I even like when people ask me, I'm like, I'm a Mexican American. I'm both
ish,
but not really. Yeah, I never know where I lie between, and it's an interesting conversation for sure.
No, for sure. We had Crystal Martinez. She's a lawyer in L.A., and she was like, "Well, the way I see it now, I'm just enough Honduran and just enough American."
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah,
and I like that. I like that answer from her. So, you know, this is an identity crisis that's like common among DACA recipients.
For sure.
How did that impact you high school, like as you're becoming and you, Hector, as an adult?
Yeah.
How did that impact you? Were you quick to jump into relationships, you know?
Yeah, that's interesting. No, not really. like I said, I'm very hard. It's very hard for me to make friends, like especially like in high school. It was very interesting. So I sort of lean more towards like the nerdy group. I want to say like I was all in all these like advanced math classes and science classes that like I sort of related to that sort of group a little bit. And but it was always hard for me to make relationships because like I said, I'm like for the Hispanic group, I was always too white to fit in. Like I was going back to elementary school, like I was in ESL class, but there was also like a Spanish speaking class in that same school, and they had their own group. So it was like very interesting to sort of like, I don't like would relate to them as much. Like I would, of course I played soccer and like I wasn't very good at it, but it was always very hard to relate to the groups that were sort of in high school and middle school. Is I don't know where I'm at. Like I'm like, I play soccer, but I don't really like, I'm not that good. And there's this other group over here that they're into like, I don't know, like anime. And I'm like, no, I'm just not into that. And oh, there's this other group that's into like fashion and looking good. And I'm like, no, not really. Like, I'm like, okay, what am I like? Okay, yeah, I'm like math and science. Okay, all right. Like, there's an engineering group. Okay, all right. Let me join the engineering club at Klein Collins. And I was okay, this is where I sort of somewhat fit in, like with similar interests. So it was very interesting growing up and finding my niche.
I wanted to. So you on a. The year 2012, yes, when President Obama announced DACA, you were, I think you were like a junior or sophomore?
I was a junior.
You were a junior, okay. Junior, yeah. Yeah, because I was a senior going on to graduating 2013. What was your feeling? Do you remember exactly what happened that day? You know, because for you, like being a junior in high school, you are getting ready to, you know, college is a big talk during your junior year of high school. Yeah. You know, you're starting to, you know, apply, sending out your application and all that stuff and applying for financial aid and all the fun stuff. What was, do you remember when you heard the news? Like, what was your reaction?
Yeah, I have that memory like very ingrained in my brain is that day I was. So my parents were currently, they had their bakery. We had a bakery at the time. And during that summer, I was working with my dad. Like we would get up at 5 a.m. and go to the bakery. And he was teaching me how to make all these different breads. And I was like working with him. We would always have the radio playing in the background. And we were listening to Piolín, Por la Mañana. And
Raúl Brindis,
Piolín Por la Mañana, Stereo Latino, yeah. And we were working, and before that, I don't think we really knew of anything that was going to be announced. We knew that, like, the year before, there was the Dream Act was coming back, and they were, like, it was in, I think, I forget where it was, but, like, the Dream Act fell through, and We knew that like maybe Obama was going to do something about it, but I wasn't like we weren't too optimistic about it. So that day I was working with my dad and we had the radio playing and we hear in the radio that Obama has announced this new plan, the DACA, and this is going to benefit like these dreamers. And I was just like, my dad was like, did you hear that? And I was like, I think so. But I quickly went towards like, oh, this doesn't apply to me. I don't know why. Like in my mind, I was like, this is too good to be true. I like my parents are freaking out. Like my dad called my mom. My mom immediately showed up at the bakery and they were like, this is great. And I'm like, no, this can't like this isn't true. This is too good to be true. This doesn't apply to me. And they were like freaking out. And I was being very like pessimistic. I was like, oh, no, this isn't for me. And eventually, like we got home and we watched the news and we saw like what it was all about. And that day, like I remember myself crying. My mom was crying. My dad was crying because it meant like getting a license. And at the time, I was trying to figure out where I was going to go to college and all these different like questions and doubts and things that like we didn't know how to do or what to do because my parents never went to college and we didn't know how the system worked and the school really didn't help you out. We were trying to figure out like how do applications work and how to find the funds to actually go to college. Yeah. So at the time it was very impactful. We immediately started gathering documents and calling the lawyer but it was very, I want to say life changing because at the time, of course, I didn't have a license and I never like my dad was teaching me how to drive, but I was getting to the point where I was like, OK, like my dad was like, you're going to have to learn how to drive before you go to college. And I was going to get my license. So I took like driving class. I don't know. It was just like life changing like day. And after that, things just sort of like I want to say like fell into place in a way. So I remember that day very, very clearly.
Yeah, that day was, I think it was life changing for all of us. For me, I was in my senior year and I was thinking like, I still don't even know where I'm going to go to college because I don't even know if I can even go to college. Yeah. I don't have a license. Like how, like, it's embarrassing to think about that my mom's going to have to drop me off.
Yeah.
Because my parents were like, did not want me driving without a license. So I was like, that's embarrassing. Like I'm like, I'm 18 years old and I can't drive my own self to go to college. Yeah. So, I mean, what are your comments about that day,
Hugo? Oh, yeah. Well, for me, unfortunately, like I had already finished school. So like high school was done.
Yeah.
And it just hit me that it was like, I was trying to figure out how to go to U of H. I got into the engineering school at U of H and get aid. So for the longest time, it was like U of H seemed like a dream. Mm-hmm. And I say long time, it's like I had to figure it out. It was announced June 15th. Obviously, I graduated the 1st of June. So it was like rapid fire. Okay, yeah. Wow, you got this now. You might as well stay here and not go to Chihuahua. You might as well take advantage of the engineering school at U of H. And it was just like, that month was like rapid trying to figure this out. But
yeah.
I want to go back because the more you bring up about your parents, the more amazing they are. They had a bakery.
Yeah, they're honestly like pretty amazing. Yeah. And at the time before getting into, they decided to buy a bakery. So before even buying the bakery, like my parents knew nothing about bakeries, like knew nothing about making bread. So they like once again they took that leap and decided to get into that business and figure things out pretty much like I mentioned before, and they always find a way to figure it out and learn how to make bread and figure out resources and tools to figure things out pretty much. Yeah,
that's awesome. And bakery in the sense of like bolillos, conchas.
Banana, yeah exactly.
Bolillo. What's your favorite? I gotta ask.
Always if it's coming out of the oven, a concha. Chocolate
yeah.
Concha. Oh man,
with chocolate concha.
With hot chocolate. Yeah, like I would literally all day, like during the summers, like all day I would smell bread all day, like whether it be conchas, cuernitos. Oh my god, like I
do your parents still have this bakery and all
no,
this?
No, I was
like, because I'm like, we need to shout them out so we can so people can go and visit people that are here in Houston.
They love to jump around and they get bored with like.
So they are like true at heart entrepreneurs.
Yeah,
they really.
And they get bored and they're like, let me try something else.
Wow.
Yeah. So I've always helped during the summers with whatever business they're a part of, and I've learned how to make tortillas, bread, be a cashier at a carniceria, anything. Like it's been an interesting growing up during the summers and learning all those different businesses.
What was your favorite job in your parents' businesses and why?
I think it was the bakery because it's very manual. It's very hands-on. Like you're working with the dough and you never really think about how a concha is made. And once you see it, you're like, oh, okay, yeah, this makes sense. And it's really cool seeing all these different ingredients come together and make such a delicious piece of bread.
And not to get like too meta or high, you know, like too like woo, but it's like almost like a perfect metaphor. It's like your ingredients were coming into place in the bakery and now your dough is rising.
There you go. Wow. Yeah, I like that. Yeah, that's good. I love that.
Amazing, man. That's a beautiful story. And then so tell us what happened. You know, you got DACA and then kind of what steps led you to U of H?
Yeah, so interesting enough, I got DACA. I started applying to colleges, and I decided to go to UTSA. I was currently pursuing an engineering degree. I was like, okay, I'm going to be doing engineering. I think I like it. Let's get into it. And I went to UTSA. I went to San Antonio for a year. I tried it out. I was going through some mental illness sort of stuff at the time. Yeah. I went to a different city that I did not know. It's hard for me to make friends, and I hit this like sort of stage in my life where I was not doing okay. So I went through my first year at UTSA, and I decided I needed to come back home. And I came back home, and I started working on myself, and I was like, okay, what am I going to do now? Like, I can't go back to UTSA. Engineering was definitely not my thing. I soon realized. So I came back home and I decided to apply to U of H again because I had applied to it before, and I just decided to go to UTSA. So I decided to apply to U of H, and I was like, I don't know what major to do. Like, I guess I'll figure it out. I just need to continue taking classes. So I applied to U of H again, and I started school back up, and I took a couple of like business classes, and I was like, this is pretty interesting. Like, this is kind of my thing. Like, I grew up sort of in this business sort of environment, and I kind of like it. So I was like, I think I'm going to go towards like a business degree. And I started taking classes, and I got involved with this student organization called Enactus, and it was very interesting. And interesting enough, it's a nonprofit organization, a student-run nonprofit organization that has chapters in a bunch of schools in the U.S. and outside of the U.S. as well. But we would use our entrepreneurial spirit and apply it towards towards helping the community out. So creating sustainable solutions to help out the community, whether it be through our own projects or working with other nonprofits in the Houston community and figuring out something that where we could use our expertise and our skills to help out in whatever way we could. So in that nonprofit, I met a lot of my friends, and I got involved with all these nonprofits, and I was really like, I was like, yeah, this is my jam. This is my thing. And this is where I sort of fit in, and this is what I like. And I decided to go towards getting major in finance because numbers are just my thing. But I was just really, really interested in this whole nonprofit thing. And I worked with so many great nonprofit organizations throughout my 3 years of being with Enactus, and I was like, I kind of like this entrepreneurial sort of thing, and let me dig into it a little bit more. And I know that there's a entrepreneur major at U of H, and I heard it's okay. It's pretty good. So yeah, that's where I sort of figured my way through college, and it was definitely interesting during my first year at UTSA. And I was like, I need to figure this out. Like I'm not doing okay. Like I need to come back home.
Let's talk about that, because that happened to me too.
Yeah.
So maybe this could help some people. You know? Mm-hmm. What? Cause it sounds like you hit it. Like you went through a depression.
Correct.
An episode of depression. Mm-hmm. I had that same thing, and I, in the same way, rather than going into like nonprofit entrepreneurship, I took the summer of my sophomore year to go take care of kids at the YMCA as summer camp counselor. Wow. Yeah. 10 6-year-olds. Hardest job of my life.
I can imagine.
Yes, sir. So what led to that episode of depression? And just tell us a little bit more about like your experience at UTSA. And
yeah, so it was, I guess freshman year, I got dropped off by my parents, and I decided to get a one bedroom apartment close to campus. And it was interesting, sort of. For one, it was my freshman year. There's so many different things going on, and all these different classes and new environment. And for me, it's like hard making like friends, as I mentioned before. So it was very hard to adapt. I sort of felt like alone in a way. I was like living by myself, and I didn't really fit in anywhere, and I couldn't figure out how to sort of just maneuver through life. And I decided that like I needed to figure it out back home. And I knew that I knew I would go back to my parents, and it's never really something I really discuss with them.
Yeah.
Because it's not something I feel like discuss ever with.
I mean, even in the Hispanic community.
Yeah.
They don't like to discuss that stuff, you know?
They're like, oh, just go work or go do something and figure it out. Just to, like, stop being sad. Pretty much. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So it was interesting coming back home, and they sort of like figured that something wasn't right. Like with me being at UTSA, like I was coming home like almost weekly.
Yeah.
During my semester, and they realized I just wasn't doing that great. It was never really discussed, but I told them like, hey, like I think I want to go like to U of H and do something different, and I'm not really liking UTSA, and I think I need to come back home. And I think they were pretty understanding of that. They were sort of confused, but it's never really something that like I've ever really discussed with them. But at the time I was going through depression. It was an interesting year of my life, for sure.
You have all these special, everyone's like, oh, you know, you're 21 going into college, figure your life out.
Yeah.
That's a hard question to tackle.
Yeah.
Who are you going to be? What are you going to do? What are you going to invest your time in to make money after you're done with this, you know?
Yep.
So I think it happens to a lot of people. And so I guess I'll frame the question a different way. What advice would you give an undocumented DACA recipient that's going into a university environment by themselves in a hard subject? What advice would you give them so that they don't go through the same hardship you did?
Yeah, it's something I think that like I didn't realize when in my first year of UTSA is that there's so many different groups. There's so many different things. If there's something you're interested in, there's a group for it. There's like so many different people that might have the same interest as you. You like there's just something out there for you. Mm-hmm. And I think that's something I didn't really get to discover at UTSA, and putting myself out there and going to like maybe just one meeting, like and I think it's something that I stress. I've talked to a few people that are going into their freshman year, and they're like, hey, do you have any advice? And that's my number one advice, is look for a club, look for something that you are interested in, that you're passionate about, and you'll find a group of people that you relate to and you can get yourself involved with, and sort of like a community for sure, and that support system for sure. You're like, if you find that support system, that you'll figure things out and things get better for sure.
No, I definitely agree with you on that, because it's harder for us, because, you know, we don't have that support system back at home because our parents didn't go through college here.
Yep.
So they have no idea what the process is or anything. You know, signing up for college, 90% of the papers and all the thing that I did was, you know, I did it.
Yeah.
While my friends were getting help from like their parents, and their parents were like the main contact.
Yep.
I was the one who was doing it, because it's like, it's not that my parents didn't want to help me. They just didn't know how to, because this is not, this is something completely different to what they grew up in. So I do agree with you, like finding that support system, you know, there's counselors, advisors who, you know, who help you out through all of this process, especially, I mean, they'll understand, like, you know, obviously your parents didn't grow up here, so they'll know and they'll understand you. So finding, and like you said, there literally is a group for every little thing.
Yeah.
My next question for you is, you know, how was it, you know, how did you find out about this entrepreneurship program at U of H?
It wasn't until my last two semesters of college where I knew that the Wolf Center for Entrepreneurship was existed at U of H, and I heard great things about it. In my mind, I was like, oh, like I heard that they're pretty cool. They only accept like X amount of people like every year. I probably won't get in. That was my sort of mindset, like my first years as a business student. And I was like, I'm just going to stick with my finance major, and should be enough. And it wasn't until my last couple of semesters in college that I sort of started to talk to people in the program, and they were like, oh, we do like so many awesome and amazing things throughout the program. And it sort of sparked an interest in me. I started researching and going to the meetings where they introduce what Wolf Center is and everything. And I was like, oh, this is pretty cool.
Yeah.
So it was that semester, that one of the semesters where I was like, oh, you know what? I'm just going to apply. Mm-hmm. Like, what am I going to lose? Mm-hmm. Like, I'm just going to make this video, and no matter how bad I think
it is. Yeah, you have to make an awkward, like, 3-minute video about yourself, post it on YouTube, an essay. You have
couple of essays.
Interviews.
A couple of essays. The video was definitely interesting because I've never filmed myself doing anything. And then hearing myself, it wasn't great. But it was, I decided to apply, and I got the notification, I got the email saying that I was invited for an interview, and I was like, oh, okay, cool. Like, I'll try to do my best. And I interviewed, and then I had two interviews actually. So my second interview, I interviewed with the director, Dave, and I talked to him, and he was like, why do you even want to do this? He's very blunt. He's very like, why are you here? He's like, why are you here?
Why are
like,
you
what's,
here?
What's your purpose?
Yeah, there you go. What's your why?
Yeah, what's your why? And I told him, I was like, listen, like, I heard this was a pretty good program. Mm-hmm. And like, I think it's like pretty awesome what you guys do. And I had also researched the program, and I knew that they sort of dig into the why. They dig into what your mission in life is, and where you want to go, and what you're passionate about. And that was something I was sort of struggling with during my last couple of semesters in college, is where am I going to go? What am I going to do? And I think that was what attracted me the most to the program, is figuring out the why, like my why, like where am I going to go after college, and what my passion is and what my purpose is. So I decided to apply, and I went through the interviews, and I was like, no, I'm not going to get in. Like it's, they only accept 35 to 38 people. I'm not, like, there's just so many awesome, I was looking through the YouTube videos, and I was like looking through like different applications. I was like, no, I'm not interesting enough. I'm not going to get in. And then I got my name was on the list of people got accepted into the program, and it was definitely a life-changing experience.
That's awesome. I mean, I remember my, I don't know if you ever were, for me, like my coming out moment of when I like said that I'm a DACA recipient to like the world was during my Wolf application. You know, I said it in a way where, you know, I said, I'm a dreamer, but I'm like, people can either take it as like, oh, she like, you know, like she likes dreaming, or they can take it like, oh, she's a dreamer, like DACA. So I, some people got it and some people didn't. And I remember in my interview with Dave, the director, he was like, so you're a dreamer, you're undocumented. He was like, what are you going to do if you get deported, if you get in the program and you get deported? And I was just like, I was not expecting that question. I was like, oh my gosh. And I was just like, well, if I get deported, I mean, I get deported. There's nothing that I can physically or do. Or And so, I mean, after that, like, you know, I told them a little bit about my life story, and, you know, like I started thinking about it. I was like, okay, what it like, you know, I get in this program, I graduate, and what if I want to start a business? And then, like, 2 years from now, you know, they take away DACA. What am I going to do? Have you ever thought about, you know, when you were in the, like, in the program, like, what if, like, DACA gets taken away? Like, have you ever, like, thought about that? Or, like, the, what will you do if that ever happens?
Yeah, that's, and that's something we've, I think we've all lived with since 2012 is, like, yeah, this is awesome, but it can be taken away at any time. And it's always something I've thought about. It's always something that I've sort of gone through different situations where, like, okay, like, what if it gets taken away? Or I've always, I don't know, like, I've always had these conversations with my parents of, like, what happens if one of us gets deported? And we go through those different, like, scenarios and situations where it's like, okay, what if my dad gets deported? Or what if my mom gets, or what if I, if both of them get deported? And we've gone through these different scenarios and situations. And I've gone through similar sort of thought process with, like, DACA and if it gets taken away. And that's where the entrepreneurial sort of, like, spirit comes in, you know? Like, I know that, like, sure, I can have my, my corporate job, but if it gets taken away, like, any, it could be taken away tomorrow, and you never know. So I know that, like, I have that entrepreneurial spirit where I can, like, I've seen it from my parents. They can figure, if, like, they can figure it out, I can figure it out, you know? Like, I'll just, like, do whatever I'm passionate in, and I can start a business, and I don't need a work permit to be happy, you know? Like, sure, like, this is my home. I consider myself, like, the U.S. is home. And whether I have a work permit or not, like, I'm going to figure out a way to be happy here. But I'm going to fight tooth and nail to make sure that I am, like, accepted here, you know? Unfortunately, we're going through some, like, interesting times where we don't know if DACA is going to be around for much longer, but we have to figure out a way to adapt to the situation. And I think that if that ever happens, I'll figure out a way. Like, I'll figure out something to do. I don't know. I'll make bread again, or I have different interests in, like, consumer products. Maybe I'll figure something out there. Like, I know that there's a way to just live, you know, like, here in the United States without any work permit, but it's very nice to have, for sure. Yeah.
So what is your why at the end of the day? I mean, what'd you learn about yourself through the program that you're applying now?
Yeah. My why is I've been in a place where I've been unhappy with myself and, like, comparing myself to others and being in that sort of mindset. And I think my why is just looking for happiness, just looking for the thing that makes me happy, and where I'm in a situation where I'm growing and continue to grow. So I've ever since the program, I've started to push myself and challenge myself to grow, and figure, like, things out as I go. And it doesn't matter where I'm at. It's there's always a way. There's always a way. And my thought process is always, like, find a way to be happy. Like, there's always going to be a way.
What are your entrepreneurial interests? You said you had a few passions. Yeah, I mean, you got the job now, but what are your passions?
Too many to count. No, but yeah. I have one of my passions and something I definitely want to do is bring financial literacy to the Hispanic community. Mm. And that's something it's a little bit more of a priority for me at the moment. And
for people who don't know what financial literacy is, can you define it?
Yeah, that can be anything from either personal finance, whether it be like setting up a retirement plan or investments or even like setting up a bank account. You know, like I've grew up with like the Hispanic community through my parents' business, and I've seen people store their money in a tin can and
under the mattress.
Under the mattress, yeah. Like, I think it's the financial literacy gap in the United States between Hispanics and non-Hispanic whites is tremendous. I don't know the number exactly, but it's something that definitely needs to be spoken about. And there are resources out there that we need to take advantage of, and I think is very important to make sure that our community is thriving and we provide those resources and tools to people, whether they want to, like I said, from setting up a bank account to helping out a small business and figuring out how to do their taxes and make their business official. And there's so many different policies and things that like we can be taken advantage of that many people don't know about. So it's something that I'm definitely very passionate about. It's been my number one priority. So I'm trying to figure out how I can make that happen within our community.
So right now the problem is there's a gap between the financial intelligence of the Hispanic community generally compared to other communities. What's the solution? Is it generally awareness? Because you said there's resources out there.
Yep.
Or would it require something innovative? What do you think?
I think it starts with awareness. It starts with like people knowing that this exists and knowing that there are options out there. I think it definitely starts with awareness, and then comes the innovation, and maybe whether it's figuring out a way to spread the word as efficiently as possible, or finding a sustainable solution to this problem. Because one thing is like maybe just giving classes on a certain topic, and maybe like people will forget about it the next day, and it's sort of finding that sustainable solution to that problem.
Yeah. Very true. And have you seen any good solutions that maybe we could shout out?
Yeah, I think Baker Ripley is doing an amazing job with helping out the Hispanic community. And I've worked with them in a couple of projects with Enactus, and I think they're doing an amazing job here in Houston.
Yeah, I like Baker Ripley a lot. I work at the bank. We took like 50 Baker Ripley kids to the Rockets game, and it's like most of them is their first game. You know, and so they do a lot of good work. That's a good point.
Yeah, they have. I worked with them with a grocery simulator where they bring in, they teach how to buy in a grocery store, pretty much. Because in some countries, you're used to going to a market and buying from local vendors and negotiating prices. And another thing is coming here to the United States where you have to go and buy a Walmart. And you have so many options and different things you could buy, and making sure that you know how to shop at a grocery store. And it's something you don't really necessarily think about, but it's those cultural differences. And it's something that Baker Ripley does very well is making sure that they encapsulate and sort of provide those resources for the community as good as they can.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a really good point. What else? What other entrepreneurial interests?
I'm very into the consumer products. I'm in a way like a shopaholic. I'm always looking for like really cool and interesting products that
Your favorite? My brother's industrial designer.
Yeah.
Loves products. It's his thing. So what's your favorite product? Or what's the product of the time, Hector?
Product of the time. Yeah. I don't know. Because phones is sort of like gone to the point where there's not like more innovation you could get out of this product. So there are different, like, whether it be like with computers, I'm more in the in, like, mechanical and industrial sort of industry.
Yeah.
When it comes to consumer products, whether it be like CNC machines and all that sort of stuff. So
okay.
I'm leaning more towards that part, but I'm all honestly like into any sort of consumer product. Like if I find a product that I'm like, oh, this is like amazing, this is innovative, even if it's like, I don't know, like makeup, I'm like, wow, that's like, that's cool, that's awesome.
Yeah.
Like I'm always looking at different things and I'm like, oh, that's pretty innovative and awesome. And I'm always thinking about and sort of processing different ideas, and it's always been in the back of my head.
Yeah, one of the like trends I've noticed recently,
yeah,
with consumer products is the watches. You know, I've seen a wave of my friends start to invest in like a Garmin watch or Apple Watch.
Yeah.
And it's because of the health capabilities and, yeah, features within the, mm-hmm, watches. Like it tells you when you're stressed,
yeah,
you know, how well did you work out, how many steps did you take.
Yeah.
So it's interesting, like you said, like phones, the innovation of phones is like kind of capped because they're,
yeah,
already limitless, but the watch is like the next thing in my,
yeah,
eyes. I don't know, what do you think?
Yeah, no, I completely agree with that. I bought myself an Apple Watch, and ever since I got it, like I pushed myself to work out, and I've been working out ever since I graduated. I gained like 50 pounds in college.
What do you gain? Yeah,
well, because they feed you. So, yeah, so I gained like 55 pounds in college, and I was like, oh man, so I started working out, and like, thank you. And I like my watch is like, hey dude, like you need to move. I was,
yeah,
like, okay,
yeah,
yeah, okay. So I started working out daily, and it's been definitely a tool where I know that I need to be moving, I need to be working out, and it's honestly life changing in a way, just because,
yeah,
in that aspect is knowing that I need to work on my health. So I agree that,
yeah,
like that's like a new wave of technology where people are going crazy over is
for sure, man.
All these different watches. Yeah.
How's life in the pandemic been for you?
It's definitely been interesting because I've been working from home. Like my office decided to close back in March. Yeah, so like my birthday was in March, and the whole like everything started to shut down, and I was like, okay, March 14th.
Okay.
Yeah.
I had
a small family get together that day, and then the next on Monday I didn't go back to work. I started working from home, and ever since I've been stuck at home, and I've been trying to figure out a way not to go crazy pretty much. Yeah, so I've been working out and figuring out like finding different shows, and there was a point where you're like, okay, I'm just gonna watch Netflix,
mm,
like during my free,
yeah,
time, and then you're like, okay, I need to like do something different and start working out. Okay,
to do something, right, productive,
something productive. And yeah definitely. So it's been interesting.
So where do you see yourself in 10 years?
Great question. I see myself as a business owner.
Mm-hmm.
I want to definitely start my own business and hopefully be a business owner in 10 years. I also want to grow as much as possible, work on myself, and hopefully be married and with kids. You know, it's always, I guess, the American dream in a way. I feel like there's like the term dreamers, right? And it's funny, it sounds like cheesy in a way, like calling yourself like a dreamer, but it seems like it's the modern version of the American dream. And I think that like we're like the next like generation of examples of the American dream, you know, is being brought to this country at an early age and trying to figure things out. And I want to make my community proud. And I'm going to do it whatever way possible, whether it be through entrepreneurship or through something else.
To close it, what would you tell, like a young DACA recipient, like similar that was in your shoes? What,
yeah,
advice would you have for them as they enter their moments of coming of age?
Yeah. I'll go back to finding whatever makes you happy, whether it doesn't necessarily have to be college, but if you have something that you're passionate about, that you know, and like it, know that you want to do and it makes you happy, then go for it. Like, just like figure out a way. There's always a way. There's so many resources out there that you maybe not know about that will help you towards whatever like path makes you happy. It's just figuring out that why, figuring out that what your mission is in life and doing whatever possible to get there.
Man, thank you for your time. It's been a minute or an hour 24. So
awesome.
Great podcast, man.
Awesome. Thank you for having me. Thank you for providing this platform.